Thank you so much, Regina, for an incredible keynote and for getting us off to such a wonderful start. I was debating telling everybody to just go have a good time and we'll forget my talk. But I think I have to give my talk, so here are the slides. Great. A year ago, many of us gathered in Atlanta for the National Immunization Conference. I think that you were exhilarated, but also exhausted after coming out of the first pandemic of the 21st century. And I tried to build on those themes in my opening talk, looking to this author and talking about us being in the best of times and the worst of times. Well, since a year ago, I did take some time to reconnect with the immunization community. I got to visit with school nurses in Washington State and with the public health community in West Virginia. I got to see the latest of the immunization registry in New York City and learn from the immunization providers in Utah how they manage their flu response. And I got to meet with the immunization coalitions in the state of Nevada and in Pennsylvania's Allegheny County. And I also saw the progress and intensity being made back in Atlanta, and then that incredible creativity from our program managers all around the country. So listening to all of you, I decided to stick with Dickens this year and talk about great expectations. People do expect great things from vaccines and immunizations. Polio wiped out from our country, smallpox eradicated from the world. As Regina said, parenthood itself has essentially been transformed based on the immunizations that now prevent a litany of scary infectious diseases of childhood. Great expectations aren't just a thing of the last century. About a year ago, many in this room were part of immunizing over 80 million Americans against a new influenza virus. But making a difference with immunizations is not always easy. It's been a challenging year. I know that people are coping with budget shortfalls in states and local areas with the complexity of our vaccination effort. And so I thought perhaps it was time for us to have a user's manual to help us get through this kind of difficult work. I thought something sort of like this. So like pregnancy, immunization involves a certain amount of delayed gratification. You vaccinate people hoping to protect an entire population. You're relying on smooth and efficient systems and a knowledgeable, capable workforce. But of course, a lot can go wrong during a prolonged gestation. We get used to a certain amount of discomfort, even heartburn. But at least we're starting with a strong foundation, continuing record high levels of infant and toddler vaccination. And despite what you might have heard about from the media, the vast majority of parents are still vaccinating their children. Less than 1% of children receive no vaccines at all, according to our most recent National Immunization Survey. But as I mentioned, there is a certain amount of discomfort that we really do need to prepare for. This past year, investigators in Mexico identified an increase in intussusception, or small bowel obstruction, occurring shortly after the first dose of rotavirus vaccines were given. The World Health Organization's Global Advisory Committee on Vaccine Safety reviewed these data as well as evolving information from other countries. Back here in the United States, we reviewed data on the actual benefits from rotavirus vaccination that we were already seeing among the babies that were born in the United States. And we carried out a benefit-to-risk analysis, looking at the actual benefits we'd seen and the hypothetical increased risk of intussusception that had not yet been detected here in the U.S., but we assumed the kind of level of risk that was seen in Mexico. What you see in this slide is the extraordinary benefit-to-risk ratio. For a year's worth of babies, about 53,000 hospitalizations from rotavirus would be prevented, and 48 extra intussusception cases might be occurred, 1,100 prevented hospitalizations for one excess. Based on these data, we've continued to recommend the rotavirus vaccine here and around the world. When you're expecting, you expect to have to go through a battery of tests to try to make sure that everything's progressing the way it's supposed to and to pick up problems early. In immunizations, we do the same thing. After vaccines are licensed and go out into widespread use, we want to make sure things are progressing the way we expect them to. This year, we learned that some vaccines were working even better than we thought they would. The zoster or shingles vaccine was effective against shingles, and unlike the pre-licensure randomized controlled trial, we learned that there was no drop-off in effectiveness with age, so the oldest among us were getting just as good protection as younger, older people. We also found that the vaccine protects against shingles that can affect the eye, a very severe, painful complication, as well as against shingles that was serious enough to cause hospitalization. We also got good news about influenza vaccines. Babies whose mothers received a flu vaccine during their pregnancy were significantly less likely to be hospitalized with influenza during the first 6 months of life. Unfortunately, not all the tests we've been running on our immunization program have been as good as these. We've been tracking teen vaccination. You can see steady progress in increased use of the tetanus, diphtheria, acellular pertussis, or Tdap vaccine, and increased uptake of the meningococcal conjugate vaccine. Lagging behind somewhat is the HPV vaccine for girls. And particularly worrisome is this drop-off between the percentage of girls that are starting the HPV series and the percent that are completing the three-dose series. Now, HPV is not like measles or chickenpox. We're not going to have a big outbreak in a couple years that's going to be our wake-up call that we have a lot of unprotected people. With HPV, we're vaccinating teenage girls to protect them from ever getting HPV, to protect them from getting precursors of cancer, to protect them from getting cervical cancer decades from now. These data are the wake-up call. Particularly concerning to me is what's shown on this table. You can see that there is no difference in race or ethnicity in the percentage of girls that are beginning the HPV series. Everybody has a drop-off in the three-dose completion, but what you see here is that we do start to see significant disparities in minority girls, lower coverage of the three-dose vaccine than in whites. This cannot be a difference in parental attitudes. People are starting the series, they're just not finishing them. To me, this is system failure. Well, guess what? We are the system. So I want to challenge everyone in this room, except for my mom and dad. Everyone else, you don't get an excuse here. I want you to use every skill you have. We know how to make a difference with this. We can use reminder recall with our registries. We can use text messages. What teenager in America does not have a cell phone? We can use assessment, feedback, information exchange, and really show the providers how they're doing and see if they can do better with a little incentives or humiliation. I don't want to be the immunization director who let a generation of teenage girls get cervical cancer. I think we can take care of this, and I know this community is creative enough to take this on. So that's your challenge for 2011. And it will return in my poem. When you're expecting, you need to expect the unexpected. This couple is finding out that they're having triplets. Now, who would have thought that we needed to learn about porcine circovirus types 1 and 2, or about narcolepsy until it was linked to a vaccine that's being used in Europe but not here? But to me, one of the biggest surprises of the past year is shown here. We began vaccinating teenagers against meningitis with the meningococcal conjugate vaccine in 2005, and now we have data showing that that vaccine doesn't last as long as we thought it would. We see a worrisome drop-off in protection 2 to 5 years after vaccination. These were preliminary data, but coupled with antibody tests that were run in the laboratory on a sample of patients, and with vaccine failures we were hearing about from college students who'd been vaccinated just a couple years earlier. Our Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices reviewed the data and ended up recommending a second dose of meningitis vaccine to be given to teenagers at age 16. We haven't even fully implemented the first dose, but we have more work to do here. We know that meningitis is rare, but it's extremely serious, and we really want to make sure that we're using the vaccines the best ways possible. When you're expecting, you can expect to have to make some changes. Now, how difficult it is to make these changes is going to depend on what you're doing to begin with. In immunization, we are in the middle of enormous change. Change is good, but change is hard. Over the past several years, we've radically transformed the way that we distribute vaccines. We've eliminated the inventories in every state depot and established a central distributor that ships directly to about 45,000 providers. Now we're in the middle of an enormous change in our information flow system. Many in this room have been working for decades to improve immunization registries or immunization information systems so that records from any place you got a vaccine will be accessible to a provider when a person comes in for vaccination. Recently, partly through the Affordable Care Act and efforts before it, a renaissance in electronic health records has been going on. And so our new challenge is to connect the electronic health records with the immunization information systems. 20 health departments were funded in the past year to work on this interface, and we're very optimistic that we can support more states going forward. Some of you received a notice that we're going to be asking for applications for funding for the Section 317 grantees around an area, a set of priorities. One of them is this information exchange priority. We've also been working on changing the IT system that powers our supply chain management. The VTRAC system was launched at CDC and is now being used to place bulk vaccine orders with the manufacturers and to direct our central distributor to ship out vaccines to thousands of providers around the country. In December, we began piloting the VTRAC system with 4 health departments. Those health departments now place their orders using VTRACs, and they're able to check vaccine shipment status and other things using the system. They, in turn, are working with the doctors in their communities, either to order vaccines directly with VTRACs or to use their immunization registries to order vaccines and connect the registry to the VTRAC system. And then last year, the FDA issued a new notice that permits better information, more information to be printed on barcodes. We look forward to a time when barcodes can have expiration date and lot number as well as product code and get all that information scanned automatically into the electronic health records, fulfilling the requirements of vaccine documentation, saving time, money, and reducing errors. This is a lot of change to go through, and I know that the states involved with the VTRAC pilots and those of you laboring over registries for decades have been working really hard. But I do have great expectations for what these changes will mean for our country in the next several years. We should see better decision support for providers. When they see a person in front of them, they should be able to access that decision support about which vaccines are recommended, and we should really be able to increase coverage. We should have better vaccine accountability using the VTRAC system. This is incredibly important to the policymakers and funders. We should also see better safety tracking, a better ability to implement recalls should we need to recall vaccines with the barcode advent. We should also have a better time managing shortages. Vaccine shortages happen nearly every year, and VTRAC is set up to have a special way to manage them. There'll also be other special circumstances like pandemic vaccine use. And finally, and importantly, these changes will mean more providers will be able to qualify for incentive pay related to fulfilling meaningful use criteria when their electronic health records are able to talk to the immunization registries. So we have a lot of work to do, but I am sure that we're going to be seeing a better immunization system that is sustainable with these changes. When you're expecting, you expect to get a little extra help. Well, we've been hearing calls for help from clinicians all around the country. Many clinicians have never seen the diseases that vaccines are intended to prevent. Patients and parents have more and more questions about side effects and other concerns. So we've tried to respond to this call for help, and people in our program have developed a toolkit that offers a suite of materials that we hope are going to fill your needs. We have print materials that have up-to-date stories from people who've actually had these diseases or watched their children go through them. We have an interactive website where you can find out things like which vaccines you're supposed to get as an adult or also vaccines for kids and catch-up schedules. We have videos. I'm not in the videos, but they're very good. All of this information is available at our website, shown here, vaccines/conversations. And I want you to know that even more materials are going to be posted on this website in the next couple weeks in time for the National Infant Immunization Week that is such a highlight of the year for many of us at the end of April. When you're expecting, you may find that you break all previous records. This past year, we did break some records. The seasonal influenza vaccine was produced and distributed in record numbers. The vaccine manufacturers produced 162 million doses of vaccine, and they got it out in record time earlier than ever. This was just in time for the first year of our universal flu vaccine recommendations. Everybody, 6 months of age and over, is recommended to get a flu vaccine every year. And we're really optimistic that with a more robust supply year in and year out, we should be able to start protecting more Americans and really make a difference in this infectious disease. But unfortunately, not every record we broke this year was a good record. The state of California, unfortunately, learned of more cases of pertussis or whooping cough in 2010 than have occurred in any year since 1947. 10 babies in California who were too young to be vaccinated died from the illness. California declared an epidemic, and they worked round the clock to offer vaccines to older siblings, parents, grandparents, and other caretakers, those around the youngest babies who are most vulnerable to severe whooping cough. They launched outreach to clinicians to help them better diagnose and treat this condition, and they launched a communication effort to get adults to know that they are recommended to get a Tdap vaccine. Now, California is special, but there's nothing so special about California, and I think we're going to see the same kind of problem everywhere in the United States in the next couple years. There are several sessions on pertussis at this meeting, on diagnosis, on treatment and epidemiology, a lot on communication. People in California have done a lot of work for the rest of us, so I really encourage you to learn from your colleagues and protect your communities from pertussis before you break a record, too. When you're expecting, every penny counts, and you start to really focus on budgeting for the future. Now, here in our nation's capital, it's pretty difficult to escape the topic of budget. Budgets are on all of our mind, at least even those of us who were allowed to attend the conference. We do have a number of sessions at the conference to try to get at this issue. I encourage you to go to Wednesday's session, where some of the states that have been developing billing systems will share the experience with how they're trying to bill insurers for vaccine that's given out in health department clinics and really keep their programs afloat. There's also going to be a session on Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock, where Melinda Wharton is going to talk about changes to our Section 317 program in the era of health reform. partly taking advantage of all the wonderful benefits of health reform and also finding ways to stretch our budgets further. We've got a late addition to the program also. Tomorrow at 11:30, there's kind of a late breaker in the perinatal hepatitis B session. A hint is that it has nothing to do with perinatal hepatitis B. But Feng Jun Zhou, one of our scientists at the CDC, has updated his famous economic model of the return on investment in childhood vaccines. And I wanted to give you a sneak preview of this incredible analysis. He and others at CDC have been working for months on this and promised to get it to me in time for this meeting, and I really want to thank them for doing that. It's hot off the presses. But what they found, they updated the analysis that was published in 2005, and in this analysis they added three vaccines, hepatitis A, the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, and rotavirus vaccine. And what you find in looking at vaccines against these 13 diseases in young children, we prevent 42,000 lives for every year's worth of babies. So you take a year's worth of babies, you vaccinate them against these diseases, and 42,000 of them don't die from the infections that you're preventing. You prevent 20 million episodes of disease. You save $13.6 billion in direct medical costs. And when you add in the indirect societal savings, it goes up to $69 billion. For each $1 we invest in these vaccinations, on average, $10.20 is saved. Now, when I practiced this talk with my husband, he burst into applause. So it's okay if you do too. But in 2011, these kind of data are really, really important. And so I really do want to thank Feng Jun Zhou and all who worked with him on getting us this up-to-date analysis. When you're expecting, you can expect to be awed. And there is a lot of awe in immunization. If you're a nerdy person like me, you're going to find this awe-inspiring. We began vaccinating against rotavirus in 2006, and we've already reduced disease by over 80%. These data are for here in the United States, but in January, our program contributed to a special issue of the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal, summarizing the real-world impact that rotavirus vaccination was having all around the world, throughout Latin America, in Australia, and in Europe. And with new resources, we really do hope that the benefits of rotavirus vaccine are going to reach Asia and Africa as well. Another truly awe-inspiring story is this one. People lined up at 5 in the morning to be among the first to receive a new meningitis vaccine for Africa. By now, nearly 20 million Africans have received this vaccine, and this may be the beginning of the end of epidemic meningitis in Africa, something that has plagued the continent for centuries. Well, I'm really glad you feel that way about this story, because tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock in our global plenary session, Nancy Meissonier is going to tell the full story of this incredible progress. So come to that. We'll also hear updates on polio and updates on cholera and whether vaccines might play some sort of role in the cholera problems we're having. So this past year has been filled with challenges, and at times it might have seemed like a high-risk pregnancy, but I know the history of vaccines and immunizations, and I know the immunization community, and I am still optimistic and really do have great expectations for all that we can do together. So I want to thank you for everything that you do every day to make sure that the 12,000 babies born every day in America have lives free from vaccine-preventable diseases, and that our systems are strong, and that our communities remain healthy. So thank you very much.